You know those scenes in heist movies where the thief pulls out a single glowing skeleton key and they just slide it into this massive vault door, give it a twist, and the whole thing just clicks open.
Oh, yeah. It is deeply satisfying to watch and, completely fictional.
Right.
I mean, real lock picking is so much more tedious. A professional locksmith, they don't carry a magic key, they carry a toolkit.
Yeah, that makes sense.
They have to insert a tension wrench, carefully feel out the specific binding order of the tiny pins inside that exact lock, and, set them one by one.
It's a process. And if you are listening to us today, there is a very good chance you are a student preparing for the IELTS Academic Writing Task 2. You know, you're probably aiming for that band 6 or 7.
Right.
And I bring up the whole locksmith thing because when it comes to task 2, an overwhelming number of candidates are just desperately searching the internet for that movie magic skeleton key.
Oh, absolutely. They're looking for the universal essay template.
Exactly.
There's this huge, widespread misconception that if you just, well, memorize a rigid structure, stuff your paper with a list of really rare, complex vocabulary words, and sort of glue it all together with these robotic transition phrases, you can trick the examiner.
Like, trick them into giving you a high band score no matter what the question actually asks.
Exactly, but it doesn't work.
So, we are going to completely dismantle that myth today. The mission for this deep dive is to totally demystify task 2 and give you a concrete, practical roadmap for improvement. Because, you know, if this test isn't about reciting a memorized template, we really need to know what the examiner is actually grading.
Well, the examiner is looking for a demonstration of disciplined thinking under time pressure. Task two is it's a time sequence of very precise decisions that must answer one exact prompt.
You have to read the lock in front of you.
Yes, perfectly said.
So, before we even begin to strategize about how to pick the lock, we have to know the official rules of the game. Let's look at the basic parameters. So, the academic writing test gives you 60 minutes in total to complete two distinct tasks. Task two will present you with a point of view, an argument, or a problem.
And you are required to write at least 250 words.
Minimum, right. And the general advice is to spend about 40 minutes on it.
Yes, and those 250 words, they must be connected full sentence text.
Meaning no bullet points.
Exactly. You cannot use bullet points or shorthand notes, and the tone, well, it must be in an academic or neutral style.
Now, here is a detail I really want to underline for you listening. Task two carries twice the weight of task one in your final writing score.
Double the weight.
Yes. Which makes it the absolute anchor of your result. I mean, you cannot afford to brush past it or just hope your task one graph description will somehow save you.
No, you really can't. Which means we need to understand how that anchor is actually graded.
Right, let's get into that.
The assessment comes down to four official criteria. First up is task response. This essentially asks, did you answer the exact prompt you were given, and did you develop your ideas to support your position?
Okay, so answering the actual question.
All right. Second is coherence and cohesion. This evaluates if your essay is logical and if the ideas connect smoothly from one sentence to the
Okay,
next.
and then we have the third criterion, which is lexical resource, basically your vocabulary usage, and finally, grammatical range and accuracy, which looks at your sentence variety and how well you control grammatical errors.
Exactly.
Now, let me pause on that third one, lexical resource, because I see a lot of advice out there telling candidates to memorize these lists of obscure $10 words. Like, if I just throw plethora and myriad into every single paragraph, won't that impress the examiner?
It generally does the exact opposite, actually. Yeah. Precision matters far more than just deploying big words. Think of it like putting Ferrari tires on a bicycle. The tires might be expensive and look impressive on their own, but when you attach them to the wrong vehicle, they don't make the bicycle go
You
faster.
just look ridiculous.
Right. They just highlight that the underlying machine is structurally confused. If you try to decorate a weak, off-topic argument with rare vocabulary, the examiner will see right through it. Relevance and idea development are the actual foundation.
That makes a lot of sense. So, okay, if we abandon the idea of a magic template and we stop memorizing dictionary pages, how do we actually train for this? Because when you look at the whole essay at once, it feels, you know, incredibly overwhelming.
It does, which is why we need to separate the macro structure from the micro mechanics.
Okay.
A really useful way to conceptualize this is through a master learning model developed by an organization called WeLearn. And we are referencing their framework here purely because it offers just a brilliant way to break the test down into trainable pieces.
All right, so we can actually practice it step by step. they divide the preparation into a three-part distinction. First, there's the architecture, which is how you build the response in order.
Yes.
Second, the question families, which is how you adapt that architecture to the specific instruction. And third, the transferable skills, which are the specific mechanical skills operating inside every single paragraph.
And separating your preparation into these three buckets is incredibly powerful for diagnosing where you are actually losing marks.
Because otherwise, you're just guessing.
Exactly. I mean, if you just write full essays over and over and keep getting a band 5.5, you have no idea what to fix. Are you failing to answer the prompt, or are your sentences just grammatically incorrect?
Right.
Diagnosing those issues requires completely different exercises.
So let's tackle that first bucket, the architecture of the essay. We need a reliable way to build the response in a logical order every single time we sit down to write.
Yeah, so a highly effective, flexible default sequence for your training is to start with prompt analysis, then write your introduction, write body paragraph 1, write body paragraph 2, write your conclusion, and then perform a final review.
Okay, I want to be very careful here and offer a crucial caveat for you listening. Because I see people arguing online all the time that IELTS strictly requires a 4-paragraph essay.
Oh yeah, that is a total myth.
Right. A 4-paragraph structure is never an official IELTS rule. It is simply a very safe, reliable training guardrail.
It keeps you focused. You can absolutely write a third body paragraph, but you should usually only do that if you have a completely distinct third idea that genuinely needs full development and, you know, you actually have the time to do it properly.
Well, what happens if I try to just squeeze in a third body paragraph to show off more ideas, but I only have like 5 minutes left?
You end up with a very shallow list of leftover thoughts.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Two deeply developed body paragraphs will always score higher than three shallow, rushed ones. The examiner really rewards depth of reasoning, not just the sure quantity of points you can brainstorm.
Okay, which brings us perfectly to the second part of the learning model, adapting to the question. Having a default 4-paragraph structure is a great starting point, but the moment you sit down in the test center, you are hit with a specific question. So how do you know what those two middle body paragraphs are actually supposed to do?
Well, that depends entirely on the instruction attached to the topic. In teaching circles, we often group prompts into 5 pedagogical families to help students plan.
Okay, what are they?
They are opinion, discussion, problem solution, advantages, disadvantages, and direct questions.
And again, just to be totally clear, those are teaching categories, not official terminology from the test maker. All right.
Correct. The golden rule you really need to internalize here is that the instruction, not the topic label, determines each paragraph's job.
Let's run a scenario to see how that works in practice. So let's say the topic on my test paper is international tourism. Now, I might have memorized 20 great facts about international tourism, but my essay is going to look completely different depending on the specific instruction at the very end of the prompt.
Yes. Let's compare 2 different instructions for that exact same topic.
Yeah.
Scenario 1, the prompt asks, what are the advantages and disadvantages of international tourism? In this case, your thesis in the introduction simply outlines what those points are.
Got it.
Body paragraph 1 will describe the advantages, and body paragraph 2 will describe the disadvantages. You are basically just explaining the landscape.
But what if scenario 2 asks, do the advantages of international tourism outweigh the disadvantages?
Then everything changes. Now, your thesis must make a clear, definitive verdict.
You have to actually pick a side.
You have to take a position on which side is heavier. And your body paragraphs cannot just list the good and bad points anymore. They must actively compare their weight.
Oh, I see.
If you write the essay from scenario 1 for the prompt in scenario 2, you could write a grammatically flawless paper and still severely damage your task response score.
Because you literally didn't answer the specific question they asked.
Exactly.
You brought the wrong tool for the lock. Okay, so we understand the 4-paragraph architecture, and we know that the specific instruction tells us what jobs those paragraphs have. Now we have to actually write the sentences.
Right.
This is the third bucket of our framework, the transferable skills. So let's unpack the most critical subskills, starting with the very first thing you do in the introduction, which is paraphrasing the prompt.
Yeah, so say it in your own words is probably the most common advice given for paraphrasing, and it is also the least helpful.
Definitely.
True paraphrasing relies on 5 concrete mechanical moves. You can use synonyms, you can change the word order, change the word form, like, you know, turning a noun into an adjective, change the voice from active to passive, or alter the overall sentence structure.
I want to test this because I think a lot of students just rely on synonym swapping. You know, just finding words in a thesaurus.
Hmm.
Let's say the prompt is about government spending money on space exploration.
Okay.
If I just swap out words, I might write, regimes squander currency on cosmic voyages. I mean, I've changed the words, but it sounds completely bizarre.
It sounds bizarre, and worse, it changes the fundamental meaning.
How so?
Well, squander implies wasting money, which is an opinion the original prompt did not actually state.
Boom.
And regimes often has this negative authoritarian connotation that governments simply does not. Precision is paramount here. A paraphrase that reads beautifully but accidentally shifts the core logic of the prompt, well, that will directly hurt your score.
So it is much, much safer to change the grammatical structure, maybe turn spending money into the allocation of funds, than to just hunt for fancy synonyms.
Definitely. It's so much safer. And once you have accurately introduced the topic, you need to state your position. Your thesis must be arguable. Yeah, if no reasonable person could possibly disagree with your thesis, you haven't written a position, you've just stated a fact. And that clear position needs to be visible in your introduction, defended throughout your body paragraphs, and restated in your conclusion.
Okay, but I often see students write things like, I agree with this statement for two main reasons, cost and time. Is that a strong thesis?
I would highly advise against that.
Why?
When you preview your exact body reasons in the thesis, you are essentially spinning your body paragraphs before you even get to them. State your overarching position clearly, sure, but save the specific development for the body paragraphs where they actually belong.
Speaking of those body paragraphs, let's talk about how to start them. Because every paragraph needs a topic sentence. Can I just open with something generic like, there are many reasons for this issue?
No, that sentence does absolutely zero work for you. A topic sentence has one specific job. It must name the single distinct claim that the entire paragraph exists to support. It acts as a signpost for the examiner.
Okay, so I write a strong, specific topic sentence. Now I have the rest of the paragraph to fill. And I'll be honest, my instinct is to show the examiner how knowledgeable I am.
Right.
Like, if the topic is public transport, I want to write, public transport is cheap. It reduces pollution. It eases traffic congestion. It is safer than driving. Boom. That's four great points.
That is a classic trap. And it is genuinely one of the main reasons candidates get stuck at a band six.
Wait, really?
Yes. What you just described is a list. A list of four true claims demonstrates zero reasoning. The examiner doesn't want to see a pile of stones. They want to see you build a bridge.
Build a bridge. I like that. So how do I actually do that?
By creating a logical chain. After you make your initial claim in the topic sentence, you must ask yourself, so what follows from that? You answer that question and then you just ask it again.
Okay, let's build that chain right now. Instead of listing cheap, green, and safe, let's just take the first idea, which is cost. My topic sentence is, public transport offers a significantly cheaper alternative to private vehicle ownership. Now I ask, so what follows from that?
Right, so your next sentence might be, because the cost per journey is lower, it puts daily mobility within the financial reach of lower income households.
And then I ask, so what? Again, this increased mobility in turn grants these individuals wider access to employment opportunities and education hubs that would otherwise be inaccessible.
Yes. Now you are showing real critical thinking. Three developed linked sentences prove your ability to construct a logical argument.
Whereas five isolated claims just prove I can memorize random facts.
Exactly. Always build the chain.
And part of building that chain is using relevant examples to ground these abstract ideas in reality.
Yeah.
But I see so many candidates inventing fake statistics. They will so confidently write, a recent 2023 study by Oxford University found that 83% of people prefer buses.
Yeah, please don't do that. The examiner knows you don't have access to an academic database in the exam room. You do not need to invent fake numbers.
So what should we do instead?
You make abstract claims concrete by illustrating the mechanism of how a real-world scenario actually works. You can just explain that in densely populated cities, designated bus lanes allow commuters to bypass rush hour traffic, making it a more efficient choice. It's just about illustrating the how.
Got it. Now, as we're linking all these ideas together, we have to talk about cohesion. We mentioned earlier that those robotic transition phrases are a bad idea, but I still need to connect my sentences somehow, right?
You do, but you should choose your connectors based on their logical function, things like addition, contrast, or cause and effect. A connector is a claim about how two ideas relate to each other.
Okay.
Don't just throw in furthermore because you haven't used it yet. Only use it if you are actually adding a parallel point.
Now, one of the most sophisticated logical functions is contrast, and concession. What does a genuinely good concession actually sound like?
So a concession is when you acknowledge a valid point from the opposing view before explaining why your main position is still stronger.
Showing you've thought about both sides.
Exactly. It shows the examiner you have critically examined the whole topic, not just your side. For example, you could write, despite the high initial cost of building a subway system, the long-term economic benefits far outweigh the initial debt.
Ah, so you are admitting the subway is expensive up front, but your position survives that fact. There is a massive grammar trap students fall into here, though, isn't there?
Yeah.
Using although and but in the same sentence.
Oh, it is incredibly common. A student will write, although the scheme was expensive, but it went ahead.
Yeah, because they feel the need to really emphasize the pivot.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the mechanics of the grammar just don't require it. Although already establishes the contrast. By adding but, you are announcing the relationship twice, which causes a grammatical error.
It's redundant.
Yes. It should simply be, although the scheme was expensive, it went ahead.
Okay, so we are rounding out our transferable skills here. We also need purposeful sentence variety. So using simple, compound, and complex sentences for an actual reason. A short, simple sentence can be incredibly punchy for concluding thought, while a complex sentence is perfect for showing cause and effect. And finally, the last sub-skill is the critical final review.
That review is your absolute last line of defense. It is where you check your task response, verify your logic chains, ensure your position hasn't drifted off topic, and catch basic language errors.
Okay, so we have our four-paragraph architecture. We know how to adapt to the prompt families, and we thoroughly understand the micro-skills, like building chains and paraphrasing. Now we have to actually execute all of this against the clock. Let's look at the 40-minute routine.
Yes, a very practical time management strategy we can borrow from the well-earned training material is the 5:35 target.
5:35.
And again, this is just a practice target to aim for, not an official IELTS time allocation.
Right, so it breaks down like this. You spend a flexible 5 minutes decoding the prompt, determining the instruction, and planning your paragraph jobs. Then you spend about 30 minutes actually writing the essay. And you reserve the final 5 minutes for that critical review we just discussed. Nice. Let me throw a really common nightmare scenario at you.
Okay, I'm ready.
I do my 5 minutes of planning, my 30 minutes of writing, and I get to my review. I count my words, and I am sitting at 230 words. I am under the 250-word minimum, and I only have 3 minutes left. Should I just quickly write a couple of filler sentences, maybe summarizing my conclusion again, just to hit the count?
No, absolutely do not add fluff. Empty filler will immediately hurt your coherence and cohesion score.
So what do I do?
Go back into your body paragraphs, identify the least developed point in your argument, and extend its reasoning purposefully. Add one more link to your chain.
Ah, I see.
Just ask, so what follows from that? One more time, and write a compound sentence explaining the outcome. You will easily hit your word count, and you will actually improve your task response score in the process.
Wow, that is a much smarter strategy. Okay, so knowing this 5:35 routine is incredibly helpful, but how does a listener actually get better at it week over week? Like, if someone's test is in 2 months, what should they do when they sit down at their desk tomorrow?
They need to build a concrete weekly improvement loop. Writing full 40-minute essays every single day is exhausting, and honestly, it's pretty inefficient.
Yeah, that sounds like a fast track to burnout.
Exactly. So here is a highly actionable cycle you can use. Step one, write a timed baseline essay to see where you currently stand.
Okay. Step two is to diagnose it. But I shouldn't just read it once and give myself a guess at a band score, should I?
No, definitely not. You should diagnose it 4 separate times, looking through the lens of a different official criterion each time.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Read it once, solely asking, did I answer the prompt? Read it a second time, only looking at how your sentences connect. Then read it again just for vocabulary, and then a 4th time just for grammar.
That perfectly isolates the problems.
Yeah.
Okay, step three, pick 1 weak sub-skill.
Let's say during your diagnosis, you realize your concession sentences are always clumsy and ungrammatical. For step four, you are going to practice that single skill. You don't write a full essay. You pull up 5 different prompt families and you just write 5 concession sentences.
Oh, I love this. You are treating it like a drill in sports. Uh-huh. Now, you don't play a full match to fix your free throw. You just stand at the line and shoot 50 free throws.
Precisely. Then, for step five, you go back to your baseline essay and rewrite the section that contained the error, but this time using your newly sharpened skill.
Okay.
Step six is to transfer that skill into a brand new, full-timed essay. you will find that the muscle memory carries over beautifully.
And the final step in the loop is maintaining an error log. Keep a simple notebook tracking your recurring mistakes so you know exactly what to drill the following week. It is incredibly surgical. Write, diagnose, isolate, drill, apply.
Breaking a massive, intimidating exam down into trainable, manageable pieces, well, it removes the anxiety and replaces it with a very clear sense of progression.
Let's bring all of this together. The core takeaway we want you to leave with today is that Task 2 is not a memory test. The examiner is not looking for a candidate who has swallowed a dictionary or memorized a rigid, one-size-fits-all template.
Not at all. True mastery of this exam and of academic writing in general is the ability to repeatedly read the exact instruction in front of you and decode it.
Right.
It is the ability to choose a defensible position, assign every single paragraph a specific job, and develop those ideas with clear, logical chains of reasoning.
You don't need a magic skeleton key when you know how to read the lock. You have the toolkit now. You know the official criteria, the flexible architecture, and the mechanics of building an argument.
Yeah.
So, and everyone listening, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We really wish you the absolute best in your IELTS preparation.
And as you continue studying this week, keep this final thought in mind. We have spent all this time analyzing how to answer the exact prompt provided.
Yeah.
Over the next few days, as you read opinion pieces in the news or, you know, listen to politicians debate on TV, ask yourself, are they actually answering the specific question they were asked, or are they just reciting a pre-memorized template of talking points?
That is a great question.
You might be surprised how often professional, real-world arguments would completely fail the IELTS task response test. Keep analyzing the logic out there, and your own writing will naturally improve.